Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Iraqi government has proclaimed the liberation of Mosul as government forces take the mosque where the so-called Islamic State was declared 3 years ago to the day. Is this truly the end of ISIS in Iraq? And what about U.S. troops? Are they there to stay? South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, comes face-to-face with Donald Trump today at the White House. Moon has expressed optimism about talks on resolving the DPRK nuclear issue. He favors a peace treaty, but will he be able to really turn the tide in Korea away from confrontation and toward dialogue? The U.S. State Department has announced that it's downgrading China to its list of the world's worst offenders when it comes to human trafficking, accusing them of assisting alleged slave labor operations run by the North Korean government. But what's the real rationale behind this new move? And we are proud to announce that Loud and Clear and other Sputnik shows are going live on 105.5 FM in Washington, D.C. starting this July. But first, we turn to the situation in Mosul and Iraq. We are joined from London by Mujtaba Masood. He is an Iraqi journalist and a filmmaker whose films include Islamophobia, Cause and Effect and ISIS. Islamic extremism? Question mark. Welcome back, Mujtaba.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Iraqi forces say they have captured the great mosque of al-Nuri in Mosul. Is it a strategic victory, a symbolic victory? How big of a deal is this?
Well, I think more or less the Iraqi army has gone through Mosul quite quickly. The expectations were it would take longer. The urban warfare, the street-to-street battles would last longer. Thankfully, that hasn't been the case. They've been able to push through most of Mosul now. And it was coming. I think the way that they moved into western and eastern Mosul, this victory, especially right now, is symbolic because of the mosque, which Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, which was where he was filmed, from that mosque, and as a result of them taking this mosque, it's more symbolic. It's a symbolic statement in that the caliphate has finally fallen. So it's very important. It's strategic as well as symbolic, but definitely that mosque that was taken today was symbolic in because of Abu Bakr Baghdadi.
Yeah, and Baghdadi is, for our audience, he is a caliph or self-appointed caliph, the leader of the so-called Islamic State, Daesh.
Yeah, he's a self-proclaimed leader, yeah.
Self-proclaimed. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called the mosque's destruction last week, and ISIS apparently destroyed the mosque when they knew that it would be captured, as it has today, by Iraqi forces. The Iraqi Prime Minister said, this is an official declaration of defeat by Daesh. In other words, when they blew up the mosque where Baghdadi made, I believe, his one and only public appearance, at least one that the West, that we in the West saw. Do you agree with the Prime Minister?
For sure. I mean, I think ISIS themselves recognize the importance of losing that mosque. The minaret, which is a very famous minaret in the old city of Mosul, was blown up by ISIS themselves. It's quite a you know, when a war is being lost, the opposition or the losing side will tend to destroy anything that they view as symbolic to those who will triumph. And only a few days ago, ISIS senior leaders, I presume, blew up the mosque, the minaret, when they could see that Mosul was falling. They understand the symbolism with losing that mosque. And that's why today is very, very, very big for Iraqis. There are Iraqis leaving from the south, going towards Mosul to celebrate with their brethren in Mosul. And so the symbolism behind that mosque is massive. It's the only public appearance, as you mentioned, that Abu Bakr Baghdadi made. He made it in that mosque. It was a sign of strength. for ISIS. And as soon as that mosque fell, it was the end of ISIS. And it is the end of ISIS in Iraq in terms of having any state or having any territory. They'll have to go back to Al-Qaeda-style terrorism in Iraq.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. I mean, they've lost the territory, and thus the magnet of having a physical caliphate, so-called, in Iraq. They still haven't lost Raqqa in Syria and other territory in Syria. Again, the Iraqi prime minister says they're defeated, and that's the main message here in the mainstream media. ISIS is, in essence, no more. But from your point of view, can it keep going as an underground movement? Will it keep going as an underground movement? Will it just sort of go through some sort of transition or transformation? Or is this really the end or very close to the beginning of the end?
I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we thought ISIS was completely annihilated in Iraq, especially since it has so much strength right besides Iraq and Syria. I think Iraqis understand that themselves, the politicians and the civilians as well. The general Iraqis understand that there is a risk of terrorism. It will go back to Al-Qaeda-style terrorist attacks, which is continuing at the moment. We saw a terrorist attack in Baghdad where ice cream shop was blown up. And time again, attacks in Baghdad do happen, and they increase when ISIS is losing a battle. So I think it's not the end. It's certainly not the beginning of the end. We still have a long way to go to defeat the ideology of ISIS. It's measurable to say that ISIS has lost in terms of territory. It's very easy to say how many have died and what territory we've taken back, but the ideology, the idea of ISIS still remains in many extremists within the country. Raqqa is still doing quite strong in Syria. The unified fight that we saw against ISIS isn't the same in Syria. In Iraq, we had the Peshmerga, the Kurds, the paramilitary forces composed of mainly Shia-led forces. We have the Iraqi army. They're a lot more unified in the fight against ISIS. Whereas in Syria, you've got many forces, and usually they're engaged fighting each other. Like, for example, the Assad forces, the Syrian government, are engaged with fighting the Syrian rebels, and likewise. And therefore, there's less of a strategy in terms of defeating ISIS in Raqqa. So ISIS will remain in the region, it will remain in Iraq, and it's a generational thing. I think it's going to take a lot longer to remove them from Iraq.
We are speaking with Iraqi journalist and filmmaker Mojtaba Masood. We're speaking to him about the fall of Mosul, the liberation of Mosul. Mojtaba, that whole area of Iraq, not just Mosul, but the western area, the Anbar province, I mean, it's been through so much. I mean, when you think about what happened in 2003 with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and then again 2004, 2005, we had the massacres in Fallujah by U.S. troops, the Haditha massacre. So the country and those areas have been plunged into so much misery as a consequence, I would say, first of the U.S. invasion and then what happened later under the occupation. Does ISIS have, as a consequence of all of those things, a base of support from within the indigenous population? In other words, not simply a particular ideology or theology, but based on their claim to represent people who have been targeted or who have been victimized by sectarian violence or by American troops? I mean, is there a base of support that's beyond its ideological hold?
Well, I mean, there is a sense of marginalization and people are aggrieved, whether it's perceived or genuine. The region you're referring to, which is, we saw the Triangle of Death, it's known as, which is around Fallujah, Ramadi, and mainly the Anbar province, and going up all the way to Mosul and also above Baghdad, which is Tikrit. That area there has always had some sort of hostility with the central government in a way. They've always resisted much of what central government does in Baghdad. Some rhetoric that we saw during Nuri Maliki's time they viewed the central government as a Shia government, and they were resisting in a way with protests and so on. And you could say that the ISIS's emergence, the ease in which they took Fallujah, by the way, they didn't take Mosul first. ISIS managed to take Fallujah first and then Mosul. The ease at which they took that region, it was because of disenfranchisement with the central government. There wasn't much of a resistance that were willing to fight ISIS because they were unhappy with the government, and therefore it was quite easy for ISIS to come and say, we will protect you, we will be the protector of the Sunnis, even though they killed more Sunnis and obviously lied to the people. But it was a way of trying to quite easily establish a hold in that region, and they managed to do that. You could say a lot of politics played a part, but also a lot of the former government, the Ba'athist regime, many of them took part of with these protests. They joined ISIS. They became the senior leaders of ISIS, the old Ba'athist government. And in a way, they were able to maintain a stronghold there. So Iraq, since 2003, has suffered the sectarian elements in 2006 and so on, played a part in strengthening ISIS's hand. And we see the repercussions of this. Now is the opportunity for Iraqis to somehow regain a bit of unity, a bit of reconciliation between Sunnis and Shias. You know, the stabilization efforts are crucial to ensure this doesn't happen again. And at the moment, we are seeing a unified force that defeated ISIS. All Iraqis, you can think of ethnicities and religious identities. However, it's the day after ISIS that all Iraqis are afraid of. What happens next to ensure this doesn't happen again?
I hear you on that. I was in Mosul in 2002, in August, September. I was part of a delegation with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. We were going all around Iraq at that time, documenting how the U.S. was bombing the country, including Mosul, every day. This was 9 months before the shock and awe invasion of March 19th, 2003. What really struck me about Mosul, in addition to being a very beautiful city and a very large city, was how diverse the city was. There were Arabs, there were Kurds, there were Muslims, there were Christians, there were Turkmens. It was this real tapestry.
Yazidis, Christians,
yeah.
Syrians.
Yeah, and matter of fact, we had I was at an event that was hosted by sort of the city leaders at that time, and it was all of those folks. I mean, it was a big cross section. Now Daesh comes in with its extreme sectarian position, captures the city in 2014. What happened since 2014? Is the diversity gone? Is that dissipated? And what will happen now? Can the city be rebuilt as it was?
Well, there's no doubt the diversity has been affected. I mean, Christians had to migrate out. The refugees, the IDPs, that had to leave as a result of what ISIS had done. I mean, the Syrian community has suffered enormously as a result of what's happened in Mosul. I'm sure many of the listeners would have followed in terms of the Christian houses, which were labeled with the letter Noon, which is a letter to say that this house is Christian. Noon is in Arabic, to as in reference to Nusayri, which basically means Christian in Arabic. And they were labeled in that way. The houses were labeled in that way. The Assyrian Christian community had to leave. Most went into Kurdistan and southern Iraq. And then also the Yazidis. The Yazidis were, as you know, were completely annihilated. Women were taken as sex slaves. Men were killed in masses. It was a genocide. And therefore, how do Iraqis reconcile after this? I mean, there's a lot of bad blood right now because of what's happened. There's a lot of anger, especially those who gave reference to their neighbors who didn't do anything, who showed sympathy possibly to ISIS. So there is some bad blood within these communities. And the way to reconcile right now is to have some sort of reconciliation efforts and humanitarian efforts that deals with the psychological trauma that's come as a result of this. How do we rebuild Mosul? How do we bring communities back together? That is what all Iraqis are afraid of. And we need this momentum of defeating ISIS and this kind of happiness that's emerged as a result of it to kind of bring Iraqis together and try to rebuild people's lives. Because we know that the diversity, as you mentioned, of Mosul is going to play a significant part in the forthcoming days. How do communities come back together? Will the Christians come back to their land? Some of them are asking for their own protection. They want their own groups to protect them, so it doesn't happen again. Yazidis want their own kind of sort of national security force, where Yazidis themselves want to protect their community. They don't trust the government to protect them anymore. And so we are in the beginning of security in Iraq and where the future holds and it requires all Iraqis to come together. It will be a difficult 2 or 3 years, I think, and we really need to focus on what will happen in Iraq. We need to focus a lot more than we did before when ISIS took over Mosul. The focus now needs to be on reconciliation of efforts on the ground between communities.
We're talking from London with Mojtaba Massoud. He is an Iraqi journalist and filmmaker. Mojtaba, the U.S. government has been bombing Iraq for 5 successive U.S. governments, even though Iraq has, never done anything to American people, has never threatened the United States. After Mosul, after the defeat of ISIS, should it be defeated, do you expect the U.S. forces to leave Iraq, or is the Pentagon's intention, or is the Iraqi government's willingness to go along with the U.S. such that you believe American troops are there to stay?
The Iraqi government until recently asked the help from Americans and actually instructed Obama to help them for the war against ISIS. And we know that if we look back on 2003, much of what has happened now has happened indirectly as a result of the policies of the post-Iraq war. America can only play a role that's limited in this capacity, because it goes back to Iraqis now in terms of dealing with the situation themselves. Any interference by the United States, politically or on the ground, can play a negative role in community cohesion between the communities. And therefore, I think at the moment the United States Army and the coalition, once ISIS is defeated, need to be in the background. They need to not interfere in terms of what happens on the political level. If America is seen to be siding with one community or one political party over another, we can go back into a cycle of events that will become endless in terms of fighting within parties. I mean, we saw the elections before, the tensions between the parties. The parties are separated based on religious grounds. You have Sunni parties, Shia parties, and Kurdish parties. Right now, we have an independence issue for the Kurds, where Barzani is requesting for the Kurds to have an independent state and pushing a referendum that he deems binding. The government in Baghdad say that this referendum for Kurdistan to have an independent state is not binding and is not constitutional. So therefore, we have a new issue right now. Well, the Kurds, I think Barzani in particular, the KDP, are using their leverage, using the opportunity of ISIS being defeated, to push through a referendum and have an independent state. That's going to play an important role. America's position on this is going to be significant. But in terms of on the ground, Iraqis do not want to see American troops on the ground, and what they say plays a massive part.
Yeah, we're completely out of time. We want to thank Mojtaba Massoud. He is an Iraqi journalist and filmmaker who's been speaking with us from London. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, comes face-to-face with Donald Trump later today at the White House. Moon has expressed optimism about talks on resolving the DPRK nuclear issue and skepticism about THAAD. But will he be able to really turn the tide in Korea away from confrontation and towards dialogue? We are joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She is a professor and fellow at the Korean Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Welcome back, Simone.
Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for joining. What can we expect from talks between Moon Jae-in and President Trump today? Moon was quoted last week by Reuters as saying, quote, if President Trump and I make strong personal ties of friendship and trust, and if we were to try to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue on the basis of these personal ties, then I believe we will be able to achieve the resolution of the North Korean nuclear issue. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that, first of all, we, instead of focusing on the latest sort of news about the President Moon Jae-in and the Trump summit from the mainstream media, we should actually pay attention to what President Moon stated in the very early, in the early part of his administration. That is, with regard to building peace in the Korean Peninsula, he said he will take a step-by-step approach and that he will resume immediately the North and South cooperations, and he will basically restart the engagement policy. And also he will, in the long run, he will aim for a peace treaty. So these are the very specific and concrete objectives that he laid out. And so I think that that's where his ultimate objective and goals are. So with regard to the upcoming summit meeting with the Trump administration, I think he's trying to be a little bit more diplomatic and take a very cautious approach, because there are a lot of challenges and criticism from his administration, from both supporters and opponents of this engagement policy. So I think that we shouldn't really exaggerate from the news that somehow President Moon Jae-in reverses earlier policy of supporting engagement. And so I think we should really take somewhat of a cautious approach.
I understand what you're saying, Professor Chun. So, again, it's a lot of pressure on any visiting head of state, especially the head of state of South Korea, a country that has a relationship with the United States, whereby the United States has essentially militarily occupied, and been the dominant outside power in South Korea since 1950. Moon Jae-in is a new president, more progressive certainly than the impeached and now disgraced former President Park Geun-hye. So in Washington, D.C., the actual words spoken by Moon Jae-in maybe sound softer towards Donald Trump, or more plain towards Donald Trump's stated hardline rhetoric. But you're saying that if you look at Moon Jae-in's statements, where he wants to go, a step-by-step approach, the beginning of North-South cooperation, eventually a peace treaty, that those are the real markers on this roadmap that we should be looking at.
Yes, precisely. And also there are other things that the mainstream media does not pay enough attention. Number one, Moon Jae-in is receiving about more than 80% of approval rate from Koreans. That is huge. That is very significant. He has legitimacy. He has the momentum. He has so that is the most important one. And secondly, also, as you might have noticed, that more than 100,000 Americans have signed a petition. They're calling for immediate diplomacy with North Korea. So, in fact, the petition has been submitted to, for instance, the one of two remaining Korean War veterans, our Representative Conyer. And so that is what we're talking about. It's not just focusing on, what Trump says. We should pay attention to also the, very strong American support, Korean Americans, and also other peace activists. That is another issue. I think the third issue that is very important is also, in my view, this is probably one of the best opportunities that we have, because, the most sort of engagement policy in North Korea kind of in the past started in the last, let's say, days or year, the last year of Korean administration. So that's including the Kim Dae-jung summit with the North Korean leader. So what happened with this time, we have for the first time, North Korea issue has becoming the issue, main issue, in the very beginning of this new administration that has huge mandate and legitimacy for foreign people. So, and now we have a President Trump, who is also still in the earlier period of his presidency. So I think if we have some major policy breakthrough here, would we have pretty much 5 years or next 8 years, right, where we can stick to the, very this policy instead of changing because of the new, change in administration. So those are things I think we should also now start talking about. Again, going back to very strong public support for diplomacy, not only in Korea, but also in the United States.
Those are extremely important points, and I'm glad you brought those up, Professor Chun, because our audience, the larger audience, perhaps the larger non-Korean audience, might not be fully aware of some of that history. But in the very what you're saying is in the very last year of the Bill Clinton administration, there was both Kim Jae-jung, who had the Sunshine Policy, like Moon Jae-in, a liberal seeking to have a thaw between North-South relations. They started to do that, and that became, in a way, the precondition for Washington also making a policy shift. And it looked like in the last year of the Clinton administration, Clinton dispatched Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, to Pyongyang. She met with Kim Jong-il, the head of state of North Korea. It seemed like there might actually be a thaw. Then the month after she was there, George W. Bush lost the election, popular vote, but won the Electoral College. And when he came into office in January 2001, he adopted a hostile policy both to the South Korean liberal president Kim Dae-jung and towards North Korea, labeled North Korea part of the axis of evil. And that basically shelved or froze U.S.-North Korea relations. What you're saying is that all happened in the last year of Clinton's administration, so he couldn't finish it. Al Gore couldn't start it or continue it because George W. Bush became president. But here we are in the first months, actually, of Trump's administration and Moon Jae-in. So if there was a transition or a change or a transformation of policy in Washington, it has the time to play itself out. That's just, I wanted to help the broader audience understand the importance of timing here.
Precisely. This is, I think, that in fact, I think probably it's the very first sort of, time that we have that kind of opportunity. You know, going back to about the Clinton administration, I think that I heard that if Al Gore would have won, there is a likelihood that the former President Clinton would have sent to North Korea, and he could have actually moved forward with his policy. But anyway, that was at the past, so it was too bad. So this time, again, I think that this is an amazing, truly amazing opportunity. Not only that, probably you might have read in the news too, there's very high level U.S. former diplomats, right? We're talking about really big, important former diplomats. Six of them signed a letter, sent a letter to President Trump, including with obviously former Defense Secretary Perry, who basically demanded that supporting diplomacy. And we had the Korea Peace Network, where I'm a member, hold a very important forum last week, and where former Secretary Perry stated, that the only thing that worked with regard to North Korea is a direct talk, direct diplomacy between United States and North Korea. So here we have not only, so that's, again, going back to my position, President Trump, although he's sort of hawkish point, I still have hopes. He's actually the one who mentioned it many times that he was willing to, meet with Kim Jong-un at Hamburger diplomacy and all that. And I think that, but what we are hearing is also that all this very conservative right-wing think tanks and all the hardliners who just wanted to take advantage and shift back to those Cold War hardline policies. So I think we need to stop that. In order to stop that, we should just emphasize, again, the strong support from the Korean people and also within the United States, all the activists and growing consensus among also policymakers, including RAND Corporation, RAND Corporation, right? That also, they also came up with the supporting diplomacy. So we have right now this awesome opportunity, and so this is what I think we should just emphasize.
Right. So we have obviously differences of opinion within the summits of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. The six individuals, including Admiral William Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense during the first Clinton administration, and who was there in 1994 when the General Framework Agreement was signed between the U.S. and the DPRK, in other words, a bilateral talk between the two countries, that they are emphasizing, and Perry in particular is emphasizing, it's not necessarily the six-party talks. There needs to be bilateral talks. And the reason for that, again, for our larger audience, is the U.S. signed, along with North Korea, an armistice agreement in July 27, 1953, bringing the actual military hostilities to an end, the Korean War, the war that took so many millions of lives and devastated the peninsula. But that armistice signed so long ago, signed 64 years ago almost, has not been replaced with a peace treaty. So the Korean War, unlike all other wars which have a beginning and an end, the Korean War only has a beginning but no end. If it were to end, if there was an effort made by both Moon Jae-in, supportive of a thaw, and a Washington policy establishment that said, okay, let's bring this war to an end, how do you think the North Koreans would react?
I think the North Korea, I think that's actually what North Korea wanted. I think that there's another dimension where North Korea said that in, or some, you know, policymakers in South Korea proposed that in exchange with, instead of having, you know, in taking more step-by-step approach, that is the first, reduce U.S. hostility toward North Korea, such as reducing the intensity of U.S. war game in the Korean Peninsula, and then North Korea will also stop its, you know, its missile tests and also moratorium on its nuclear program. So I think with the very successful, let's say, steps, I think we can build a trust, and then hopefully we will also have a peace treaty. So I think that the most important one right now is we should, you know, not only activists in United States and Korea, is that we are really, you know, the ultimate goal is a peace treaty, Korean War that has been going on for 67 years, right? This is the longest war in modern times. And the humanitarian consequences are truly, you know, it's unspeakable. We have millions of Korean families still, you know, separated. Many of them just passed away. Even in the United States, we have also American service men and women who are buried in the North Korean soil. Some of them still, you know, the families could not retrieve the remains. And also the Korean Americans in the United States who has family in North Korea been separated, you know, and they could not take advantage of the North and South Korean family union. So we're talking humanitarian consequences, human tragedy, the pain and sorrow of the war that is just unprecedented. So, you know, in the midst of all this nuclear talk, I think we should, at the end of the day, we should all really talk about the human cost of this horrible war. And the answer is peace treaty.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people who are not Korean, for, say, people in the United States, to fully understand what you're talking about in terms of the unprecedented nature of the division, because you had Korea as one nation, as a peninsula, as one people for thousands of years. And then suddenly, as a consequence of an agreement between the USSR and the United States, and principally by the United States, where the U.S. advisors drew a line across the middle of the Korean Peninsula at the 38th parallel and said, well, these will be the two Koreas, one controlled by a Soviet zone of influence, the other by an American zone of influence. And then both sides were supposed to leave by 1948, and both sides, in fact, did leave, but then the Korean War started. And since that day, since June 25th, 1950, when the war started, everything froze. And so you had, I think I saw a number where 10 million families or something, I think that's what it was, or maybe it was 10 million people from different families, have actually been divided now for 67 years, where brother could not see sister, or child could not see mom or dad. In other words, like, I don't think any other country has experienced this.
Precisely. You know, it also, Korean tragedy is also symbolized by our new president. You know, President Moon Jae-in, as you know, he's also his parents from North Korea, and he's the very, very first South Korean president whose roots is in North Korea. And his parents actually took on the December of 1950. There was a great evacuation from North Korea, Hungnam Harbor, and one ship that carried about 14,000 refugees from North Korea, and it eventually landed in southern port, Busan. Now, so in other words, you know, Moon Jae-in, the presidency of Moon Jae-in reflects his a part of family who has, separated from his own uncles and aunts and his grandfathers, all those in North Korea who he couldn't visit. So in other words, that we have even the Korean president himself shows this tragedy of a Korean War. So I think there is also that personal story is also important. And so I think going back to the importance of peace treaty, will North Korea react to this a proposal of peace treaty, and then in exchange with halting the nuclear program? I think that there are good chances, and that should be a definite goal, and we should not be afraid of or keep talking about this significance of peace treaty that will, reduce tension not only the Koreans in the world, but really the Northeast Asia, the entire region, and also the rest of the world.
Okay, we're out of time. We're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The U.S. State Department has announced that it is downgrading China to its list of the world's worst offenders when it comes to human trafficking, accusing the government of assisting alleged slave labor operations run by the North Korean government. But what's the real rationale behind this move? We are joined from Moscow by political analyst Dmitry Babich. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
Thank you for joining. Dmitry, before we get started, I want to play an audio clip for you and get your reaction to it. It's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson talking about China at the ceremony at the State Department where he presented the Trafficking in Persons report. This is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
The North Korean regime receives hundreds of millions of dollars per year from the fruits of forced labor. Responsible nations simply cannot allow this to go on, and we continue to call on any nation that is hosting workers from North Korea in a forced labor arrangement to send those people home. Responsible nations also must take further action. China was downgraded to Tier 3 status in this year's report, in part because it has not taken serious steps to end its own complicity in trafficking, including forced laborers from North Korea that are located in China.
Dmitry, what's your reaction? What do you see as the rationale for the U.S. doing this at this time?
Well, it is clear that Mr. Trump and the U.S. administration in general, they are trying to pressure China right now because they think that China is not applying enough pressure on North Korea. President Trump made it very clear during his recent meeting with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Trump basically praised Modi for cutting just about all trade with North Korea except in food. So the message from the U.S. administration is very clear. China is bad because it does not try to cripple the North Korean economy. And India is good because it sided with the U.S. in its confrontation with North Korea. It sided with the U.S. in its growing confrontation with China. And as far as human trafficking is concerned, well, you can criticize China if you yourself have a very good record on human trafficking. But that's not the case in the United States. Even the official figures from the U.S. Justice Department show that there are at least 18,000 registered cases of human trafficking in the U.S. every year. I think the real figure is, of course, much higher, keeping in mind that the United States has about 11 million undocumented immigrants from the countries like Mexico and other countries of Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, it's also amazing. I mean, I have to tell you, as a U.S. citizen, as an American, the whole thing so reeks and stinks of hypocrisy. It's hard to wrap your head around it. The United States, of course, is a country founded on human trafficking because it was the enslavement of millions of African people whose unpaid labor was the basis for the accumulated wealth of the United States, or one big pillar of it. But I want to read to you, Dimitri, from the New York Times. China is among the world's worst offenders for allowing modern slavery to thrive within its borders, according to a strongly worded State Department report released Tuesday. In its annual assessment of global efforts to end human trafficking, with an estimated 20 million people remaining in bondage around the world, the State Department dropped China to the lowest tier of its ranking this year, as it did with the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Congo. Those three nations joined 20 others already in that lowest designation, including Iran, North Korea, Russia, and Venezuela. Well, what a coincidence. I mean, what a coincidence. Iran, North Korea, Russia, Venezuela, and now China, and of course, you know, that's the modern day axis of evil. I mean, it stinks of pure politics. What do you think?
Well, you are absolutely correct. The United States itself is in tier one. So this is the highest possible grade that you can get for handling your immigrants. But excuse me, we all know the laws passed in Arizona. We know the way migrants are treated, not only in Arizona, but in many other states of America. The official figures from the Justice Department, you know, the official figures on sex trafficking, which is the worst form of human trafficking, the official figures are astounding. There are thousands of people involved in that, and 82% of them are U.S. citizens. You know, 82% of the victims of sex trafficking officially registered in the United States, they're U.S. citizens. So the whole idea that the United States is going to lecture on, to lecture the countries like Venezuela or like Iran on human trafficking, this is simply laughable. In Iran, if you get involved in prostitution rings, you get capital punishment. That's a very dangerous business in Iran. In the United States and in many countries of the Western Europe, we all know that there are hundreds of companies, hundreds of criminal rings operating. In the countries like Holland, it's even legal. You know, you don't face any danger. So, of course, when you say this is hypocrisy, I couldn't agree more. I recently visited Belarus, you know, another country which, if you read, the Western press and the American press in particular, small 10 million nation, of Belarus, it is also a part of the axis of evil. And I can tell you that the fight with human trafficking there is indeed very serious. You know, you have television, publishing advertisings, you know, telling young people not to get involved with criminal rings involved in human trafficking. You get all kinds of information, and in the recent years, I would say the 90s were terrible in terms of human trafficking in the former Soviet Union. Now the numbers are much lower simply because young people have a lot more information. If someone invites you to work, as a cleaning woman, you know, as a waitress to some other country, you can check the company that invites you. You have just about 90% of young people in Belarus have regular access to internet, so they simply can check who invites them and avoid becoming a victim of human trafficking. And now the United States is lecturing these people while it itself is profiting from human trafficking from the countries like Mexico And Venezuela also. Let's not forget about Venezuela.
Right. And of course, the United States, in the United States, there are 2.3 million human beings in prison. One out of every four prisoners in the world is in the United States. They're not legally trafficked, but they're because of forced concentrated policing. People in certain communities, poor communities, are arrested en masse. They're given heavy charges. They plead rather than go to trial where they may be facing 10 or 15 years. They go into prison and then they're hired out as private contract labor. I mean, they're in private prisons and in the state-run prisons and in the federal prisons where they're doing profit-making enterprises as slaves. They're basically, it's a new form of slavery in America. That's not even considered, of course, by the State Department as anything other than the fine working of the American criminal justice system. One of the things that was also appalled me, of the many appalling things about this, was the presence of Ivanka Trump at the ceremony where the United States got up on its high horse and talked about China and Russia and Venezuela and North Korea and Iran as the great perpetrators of this criminal, terrible human trafficking. And of course it is. Ivanka Trump has a sweatshop labor in the People's Republic of China. That's where her high brand or mid brand clothing label clothes are made, many of them in China. And here's Ivanka Trump talking along with Rex Tillerson, denouncing China. She says, ending human trafficking is among the top priorities of the Trump administration. She singled out child sex trafficking on a personal level. As a mother, this is much more than a policy priority. Meanwhile, she's got sweatshops in the People's Republic of China, and then Americans pay very top dollar for these clothes that are made at, you know, very, very, very low wages. Again, I don't know. I'm just ranting, but the whole thing, it seems to me to be the epitome of imperial arrogance and hypocrisy. Anyway, I'm just ranting. Go ahead. You can rant a little bit too, Dmitry.
Well, I would say that, of course, it is hypocrisy. And I think it's a part of a bigger hypocrisy. I mean, look, the United States and the European Union, by their own policies, they are creating a situation where millions of people live in what is basically considered to be illegal states. I mean, people in Abkhazia, for example, that is a small nation which decided to leave Georgia after Georgia became an independent state in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And they have been fighting for their freedom, for their survival. They went through a terrible war, and they live in their own country. They have been living there for 25 years now. And the United States and the EU, they simply don't recognize this state. So it's impossible to have any legal dealings with Abkhazia. The same story with the small republic of Transnistria, populated mostly by Russians and Ukrainians. These people didn't want to live in the new independent Moldova because Moldova could possibly join Romania, and they didn't want to live in Romania. They had never lived in Romania. They wanted to live in the same country with Russia or Ukraine. So in 1991, again, there was a civil war, and these people have defended their right to live as they want, you know, in their own state. That state is not recognized. It is under economic blockade right now. And no wonder you have people becoming victims of human trafficking, people who were born there, who are citizens of Abkhazia or Transnistria, simply because it is very difficult to live in a state considered to be illegal. So basically, the Western countries are pushing whole groups of population into poverty, sometimes into the devastation of war, like, for example, the population of Donetsk and Lugansk, which didn't want to live under the new Ukrainian regime. Now the People's Republic of Donetsk and People's Republic of Lugansk, they are not recognized by Ukraine, by the United States, by other Western nations. And people are just hanging in a limbo. And of course, in this situation, you have huge opportunities for criminal gangs. You have huge opportunities for illegal labor. And after that, all of these countries are going to, you know, Western countries, they are going to lecture us on the evils of human trafficking. They're going to tell us how bad that is, how disrespectful that is, while they themselves create all conditions, all the circumstances conducive to human trafficking. And then they invent nice names for victims of human trafficking. Prostitutes are now called sex workers. Well, I think that people pushed into prostitution deserve respect and they deserve help. But you don't give respect just by using a different word. You have to do something to help people get out of this situation. You should not give a nice name to this terrible situation.
The what's going to be the political fallout of all of this? I mean, China has to be outraged. I mean, here Donald Trump is going out of his way to praise President Xi Jinping. He says he's his buddy. They had a good time in Florida. Recently, he said China tried, but you know, they couldn't do it with North Korea. They tried. In other words, nobody knows what the heck that tweet meant, but it sort of sounded ominous, as if China couldn't stop North Korea's missile tests or nuclear weapons tests, which North Korea does in the face of U.S. military exercises simulating the nuclear destruction of their country. But, you know, it sounded like, anyway, the United States wanted to be better, have a better relationship with China. I mean, how does this play in China? I mean, it must have an impact politically for China to be treated like this, to be dropped down to the lowest tier of worst offenders for human trafficking.
Well, I think Trump is testing the patience of the Chinese leadership. That patience is awesome because despite open hostility from the United States and somewhat lesser but still a hostile attitude from the European Union, China is going out of its way, you know, to prevent any war of words between itself and the Western nations. The situation around the South China Sea, you know, I think it was just absurd. The United States claimed that it wanted to protect the Philippines from the Chinese expansion. Meanwhile, the president of the Philippines, Mr. Duterte, obviously, he didn't feel in any way threatened by China. He went to China and signed contracts there and declared them his friends. Immediately, Duterte was declared a cruel dictator who, you know, kills his own people by the U.S. mainstream media. Somehow, you know, there are at least 45,000 people killed in Mexico because of their so-called war on drugs, you know, forced on Mexico by the United States. And that is not considered to be a crime against humanity by the Western press. But Mr. Duterte's actions against the drug traffickers in the Philippines, that is obviously considered something very bad. So we see double standard everywhere. And we see the Chinese and, let's be frank about it, and the Russian leadership being very patient about all of these really insulting statements from the United States and from the European Union. But I think little by little, you know, China's patience is running thin because Mr. Trump has been very heavy-handed with China. He started his bombing attack against the Syrian base in Shayrat, you know, against the Syrian airfield. Well, basically, he announced it during his dinner with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping.
They were having dessert. They were having dessert, and Trump said, gosh, don't you love this cake? And by the way, I just sent 59 cruise missiles to Syria. I mean,
by the way, at least 50 people were killed, you know, together with that nice chocolate dessert, the best one that you could imagine, as Trump called it. I think that was very cynical. Now, Trump is meeting, you know, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and openly, you know, propping up Modi as an example to China, you know, saying that Modi was much more active in his sanctions against North Korea. Well, this is simply unfair because North Korea is not India's neighbor. North Korea is China's neighbor. If something happens, China will have to pay in money and probably even in human lives. India is not to be, India is not going to be hurt by anything that happens in North Korea.
I hear you on that. We've been joined from Moscow by political analyst Dmitry Babich. That's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.